From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, death and uproar in Egypt, fireworks in Congress, court drama, and scenes of disaster. Here is YouTube audio from Egypt's violent Monday. The Egyptian military poured gunfire on the Muslim Brotherhood. Hundreds wounded, more than 50 dead. The George Zimmerman trial in the death of Trayvon Martin wrapping up in Florida. Here's Chief Prosecutor Bernie de la Rionda making his closing argument.
Why does this defendant get out of the car if he thinks that Trayvon Martin is a threat to him? Why? Why? Because he's got a gun. He's got the equalizer.
And Asiana Airlines Flight 214 crashes dramatically in San Francisco in a heap on the runway. 911 calls poured in from survivors. The wait for help felt like an eternity.
Were you on the plane, ma'am?
Yes, I was on the plane. We've been on the ground, I don't know, 20 minutes, a half hour. There are people laying on the tarmac with critical injuries, head injuries. We're almost losing a woman here. We're trying to keep her alive.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, Michael Crowley of Time Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Where are we headed on immigration, farm bill, food stamps? What would you say to the jury on George Zimmerman? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News. Kelly, welcome back to On Point.
Always good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Great to have you. A lot of action in your zone this week. And from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior correspondent for Time Magazine with a big eye on the world. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kelly, and Michael.
All right. Let's go to Congress first, because it just seemed to just blow up bigger and bigger and bigger as the week went on. And just in the last 24 hours, farm bill and food stamps split for the first time since 1973. Here's chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Oklahoma's Republican Frank Lucas, talking to the House before yesterday's vote on the farm bill, stripping out the food program.
I ask you today to vote for a farm bill. Farm bill. What an amazing concept. And all of you who represent farmers and ranchers, the men and women who raise the food and fiber, who get things done in this country, when you go talk to them, they'll say, why didn't we do that all along?
It's not done yet, but amazing action in the House. Here was Democratic Congressman from North Carolina, G.K. Butterfield, saying this is despicable.
Democrats and the Congressional Black Caucus are appalled that the Republicans are determined to defund food stamps and place vulnerable Americans in a position of not being able to feed their families. Shame on you. You have removed food stamps, the SNAP program, from this legislation. I don't know where it's going to go. It looks like it's going to die a slow death. It is despicable.
Kelly O'Donnell, this isn't over. The Senate's version is a very different thing indeed. But what's the congressman saying there? Defund food stamps? They're uncoupling them. Does that mean defunding?
It doesn't. But at the moment, one of the things that people need to understand is for many people who don't follow this as closely might have been surprised in the first place that food stamps are a part of a farm bill. And what has happened historically is you are able to bring together different constituencies. You will have people who represent more urban centers or places where there is a higher level of poverty, therefore more of their constituents on food stamps, with rural America where there are all of the programs, some of them controversial, subsidies, price controls, things like that, historically, that have been directed toward the farm communities. By bringing those kinds of members together to work on a big sweeping farm bill, that which lasts 5 years, you would get more votes, get more solidarity moving forward. Well, this has hit such a huge snag because of the increase in the number of people who have been participating in food stamps and the costs associated. This goes back to the whole issue of how do you cut the government budget? How do you make trims? On the Senate side, they did make some trims, but House Republicans wanted it to be much deeper in food stamps. So they were left with a choice. Is there any way to move any kind of farm legislation forward or do nothing at all? Historically, they've always had a farm bill. So by splitting this, what they're able to do is sort of harness the rural side of it. But it leaves this big question mark for what happens with those who are depending on various nutrition programs. That doesn't mean Congress couldn't move forward with nutrition programs, maybe at a lower level than some people would like, but it separates them. And that brings more time and more uncertainty. And that's why this is so striking, because by separating them, you've broken apart what had traditionally been an alliance, and now you're taking these two things in very different directions, and it is shaking lots of heads in Washington.
Kelly, mechanically here, what is likely to come out of this? The House has unbuckled these food stamps and farm bill. The Senate, with its Republican majority there, the Senate with its Democratic majority, unlikely to do that. So do we end up just punting the farm bill again? Is this out to next year again, or what do you expect?
Well, there certainly is a recognition in leadership on both sides of the Capitol that this can't keep going on. Now, we've talked about that, if you just insert a different topic before. Where is the urgency in Washington? What can happen is if they can reach a point where they are able to conference. That was the original hope, that if there's a big difference between the Senate version and the House version, that when you meet in the final process of legislation, where a small committee of House and Senate members work together on a bill and then everybody passes it. That's the traditional way things work, and that's where the ultimate compromises happen. Can they get to that kind of a position where they can reintroduce issues like food stamps, SNAP? That makes this much more difficult because of the House action, where it's only on the rural side. So there are a lot of questions about how would they move forward to bring that piece of it, the nutrition programs, back into the conversation. We've got to see where this goes. The committees that are responsible will have to look at this, and there will be public pressure. And that's one of the things that could get attention. Remember, we're just weeks away from the big summer recess, where members go back to their hometowns and they meet their constituents and they can get an earful. And sometimes that public pressure can help to move things along.
Michael Crowley, big dynamic here. Here's another big unbuckling of an old, as Kelly says, kind of deal. I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine. Rural voters were looking for that farm bill. Urban representatives looking for food stamps if people were in trouble. Here we go again, Michael, sort of things falling apart.
Right. Well, an important story about modern Washington in the last several years is that a lot of the customs, traditions, mores that have been observed in the city for decades are kind of falling apart. We're also seeing a debate this week about whether the rules governing filibusters in the Senate should be changed, because Democrats feel that Republicans are abusing their power in the minority to filibuster nominations. And the argument is that the filibuster used to be used, you know, kind of within reason, and now it's being abused and overused. I think there's just a general sense that in Congress, a new generation of people who are more ideological than their predecessors are not that interested in the way things have been done historically, and they're willing to kind of violate unwritten mores in ways that, you know, are quite parliamentarily feasible, but just not sort of how things have been done. And I would just say, another big point here is this is the power of the conservatives in the House, which dominates everything that's happening in Washington right now. I think we'll talk about immigration reform.
Yes.
But this is just another sign of the power that, you know, to kind of oversimplify what you might call the Tea Party right wing has over the president's agenda and the Washington agenda writ large, that this, you know, relatively small number of very strong conservatives in the House of Representatives can apply a big break on Washington policy and force everyone to go back to the drawing board and regroup and figure out how they're going to try to get something done.
Old deals, understandings coming undone. I mean, maybe there are changed circumstances. Certainly, as you say, we'll come to immigration, but in the Senate, this tension over all the unconfirmed Obama appointments to lead up big federal agencies. Harry Reid this week threatening what's been called the nuclear option, reining in the filibuster, saying all they would need is a simple majority to break a filibuster. Here's Reid on Thursday.
The place doesn't work. And it's too bad. The American people know this dysfunction we have here. And all we're asking is let the president have his team.
If he does that, said Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, he'd be the worst leader of the Senate in history. Here's McConnell.
If we don't pull back from the brink here, my friend, the Majority Leader, is going to be remembered as the worst leader of the Senate ever. The leader of the Senate who fundamentally changed the body. It makes me sad. All my members are angry. I'm more sad about it.
Jack Beatty, the chemistry here going from bad to worse and worse and worse. Where are we?
Yes, and there's going to be a meeting in all historically all the historically resonant places on Monday in the old Senate chamber to try to patch things up. The old Senate chamber hasn't been used since 1859. That was not a year of great concord in the United States Senate. And so it's, historians might well draw a bar and wonder, my gosh, are we approaching something like that degree of polarization? It's an extraordinary turn of events. You know, Tom, just to get back to the food stamp thing, just for a second, you mentioned the liberal objection, you know, you're starving kids and so on. There's also a profound conservative objection to this farm bill. This is from Taxpayers for Common Sense conservative group. They say about the bill just passed by the Republicans, there's no means testing to exclude millionaire businessmen, no limits on subsidies.
For farm subsidies.
Zero cuts to insurance company delivery subsidies, no transparency on who is benefiting from taxpayer spending, continued direct payments for cotton, creates an array of special interest carve-outs for pennycress, biomass, sorghum, peanuts, and catfish. What a bill.
So are we governing, Jack? Are we governed?
We are not. I think to pick up on what Michael said, an element of the Republican caucus is in a post-governing mood. They don't want to pass anything.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Fireworks in Congress, Egypt in uproar, airliner down. Climax of the Zimmerman trial, all but the verdict. Kelly O'Donnell is with us, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News. Michael Crowley, senior correspondent for Time Magazine. Jack Beatty is here. I want to look at immigration for just a minute here. This was Congressman Mo Brooks, Republican, Alabama, talking with reporters on Wednesday after a big GOP meeting conference on this. He was saying he wholeheartedly opposes a pathway to citizenship.
I would not agree to citizenship because that is a reward for a violation of American law.
And here, Steve King, Republican from Iowa, talking on the House floor again against the comprehensive Senate bill calling it amnesty.
It is perpetual and retroactive amnesty. Perpetual is this. It goes on forever. You could never enforce the rule of law again if you exempt people that came into the United States illegally or those that overstayed their visa.
Kelly O'Donnell, there's talk that this week, after all the drumroll and anticipation of comprehensive immigration reform, it may have tipped out of possibility in the House. What do you see?
Well, it certainly is a setback after what seemed to be a collective sigh of relief when we saw the Senate act and you got 14 Republican senators, that's a substantial number, to go along with that plan. But now the House does exercise a whole different vision. One of the things we see from House members with Republican control is they just don't believe something big and sweeping is the way to go. And when you hear the comparisons to the health care law, Obamacare as they call it, they say part of the problem is it's too big, too complex to end up being good law. So Republicans in the House want to take it one step at a time. What does that mean? Doing something on border security first, not taking any of the other steps until that's resolved. Well, that might be an important issue. There might be progress to be had in that area, but it also takes a lot longer to get something done. And when you see the comprehensive, the big kinds of deals that come together, part of the reason for that is they want to, again, bring different constituencies together, like we were talking about with the farm bill, get people to buy in with different sort of centers of gravity. What is most important to them? Is it border security? Is it legalization temporary that leads to citizenship? Is it a guest worker program? People who have different views on this coming together, if they sort of all jump off the cliff together, they believe that maybe that's a better way to go. In the House, no way, no how. They're saying they have to go one step at a time. And as you heard from those sound clips, there are some House Republicans who do not believe citizenship can ever be permitted. Are there enough members in the Democratic Party and more moderate Republicans who could see a path to citizenship? We've been saying that all year long. But what's the tipping point? This was certainly a big setback this week. It certainly slows down the calendar for those who thought maybe before the August recess there could be action. It seems things are really in a perilous state right now. I'm not ready to say it's over and done with, but it is a big setback.
Michael Crowley, step at a time. Many say that will never happen.
You've got conservative columnist David Brooks writing today that this sort of stall out here, the away from comprehensive reform, he writes, could be a tragedy for the country and political suicide for Republicans. He said they can become the receding roar of a white America that is never coming back. That's pretty tough language from a very prominent conservative. How do you see the GOP looking at this, Michael?
Well, it was a very powerful column, and I think it pointed spotlighted the way in which I think there are kind of two parallel debates happening with this legislation right now. One is a more technical one that revolves around questions like, how do you secure the border? Is it doable? What will it cost? Are there loopholes in the language? There are conservatives who say, well, some of this border security language the Senate passed looks pretty tough, but look at the way the president has just delayed a provision of Obamacare. The security provisions are going to be delayed. This thing's going to fall apart. It's not going to work. It's too complicated. There's a larger philosophical or strategic political debate around this legislation, which is the one that Brooks is latching on to, which is really, does the Republican Party need to pass an immigration reform bill for kind of demographic reasons, because America is becoming much more Hispanic. Hispanic voters are becoming much more important and powerful, and they don't like the Republican Party. They don't trust the Republican Party. They think Republicans don't like them and are basically hostile to them. And conservatives, sort of more moderate leaning conservatives, like Brooks, and I believe Karl Rove has said this many times over the years, going back to the Bush administration when he really pushed President Bush to lead a charge to do this that came up short, say, yes, we have to adapt. We have to show that we welcome different kinds of Americans, that we understand the country's changing, that we understand that you can't just shut off the border and ignore a huge millions of people in this country. Whereas there's another school of thought which says, no, the Republican Party can essentially double down on the white vote, that white Americans will be enough to sustain the party at least for a little while, I guess until they can figure out some other ways to broaden their appeal. Specifically, there are some conservatives who feel that they can pick up more seats in the next midterm elections and get a bill closer to their liking. But in the long term, I think that there is a feeling that, in fact, immigration reform will create, if you have millions of new citizens who are Hispanic immigrants, they will become Democratic voters. This will actually be bad for the Republican Party in the long term. So that is this kind of larger existential debate that's going on here. And it's a fascinating one, and it could be profoundly consequential for the Republican Party.
I was just in Dallas at the Bush Institute, where former President Bush has his new library.
Yes.
And the first public event he decided to hold at that new facility was a naturalization ceremony for about 20 new Americans who come from all different parts of the world. And it was a very powerful statement. You know, President Bush says he doesn't want to be in the politics of the moment. I talked to him privately as well. He really doesn't want to be in the politics of the moment, he says. However, by having that kind of a statement, the visual as well of the former president sort of embracing each new American citizen as they received their certification and took the oath was also a very powerful symbol. When Michael refers back to the Karl Rove Bush era, when the former president tried and couldn't get something done on immigration, he is trying through a sort of symbolic and with his own historical sympathies to this issue to send a message. The big question is, does it even matter to House Republicans? And I think there's a lot of evidence that it does not. Mm. But it might more broadly to Americans to be reminded that a Republican like George Bush believes that there must be some kind of action. The specifics can be sorted out. That's the battle for the politics of the day. But the idea of changing immigration laws to improve them for the world we live in now, that seemed like a very powerful statement coming from the former president who's tried so hard to stay out of things.
Seemed, but of course it's former. He's in the rearview mirror now.
Exactly.
Big fork in the road there for the GOP. We're going to talk more about that on Monday. Interesting issue, particularly as we see this, all the anticipation and even just frankly race tension around the George Zimmerman trial. We'll look at that. Nancy in Manchester, Vermont. Nancy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to encourage all Americans to call out Congress. I call them on a regular basis. When I hear things on the news, which is every day, but I don't have time to do this every day because I'm a working person.
Sure.
But I just called Eric Cantor's office this morning and asked him, how can he look at himself in the mirror? Has he ever been hungry? I mean, like, people need
You're talking
to really,
about food stamps.
Yeah, food stamps, everything. Every time I turn on the news, it's just the Republicans against everything to move forward. The country is in turmoil. Planes are crashing, people are killing one another. I mean, it just goes on and on. Listening to your show, I could go on for 45 minutes, but call Congress. I don't just call my representative. I call John Boehner. I call whoever needs to be called. John McCain.
Nancy, we've got it. You're on them. You're calling. I don't know if they're answering at least the agenda that you appear to have in mind. Jack Beatty, here we are. Big choices for the GOP on the table in front of us. So many issues in front of Congress and so much difficulty in addressing them. This kind of great pause of a moment.
Yes, and it's an essential, I think, paralysis of government that's going to last until the logjam is broken. It'll either be broken by the election of a Republican president in 2016 or by the election of a Democratic Senate and Democratic House in that year. If there's a Democratic president and status quo in Congress, it's hard to see this changing. The new normal is almost total paralysis. I mean, that is just the way that the gerrymandered Republican districts are set up. Everybody there, as we've said again and again, is afraid of that challenge from the right, from the Tea Party. And even though majorities of Republicans in general want immigration reform, think very highly of immigration, the subset of Tea Party people do not. And they're the ones that members fear coming out to vote, and they seem to have the decisive sway. And look what they've done this week to their putative front runner for 2016, Senator Rubio. I mean, this is a rebuff right to him. This is the Rubio-Schumer bill. They've all said, oh, it's the Obama bill, but it's Rubio who's got his, you know, who risked political capital, pushed it through, and now he's essentially being repudiated by his own party.
Jack, let me take us to Rubio country and Florida. Lots of eyes on the Zimmerman trial, of course. So wrapping up arguments there this week. This was the chief prosecutor, Bernie de la Rianda, laying blame on Zimmerman, he said, in his assumptions on the night of Trayvon Martin's death in closing arguments yesterday.
A teenager is dead. He is dead through no fault of his own. He is dead because another man made assumptions.
Assumptions. He's suggesting there that a young black man in a hoodie is trouble. At a news conference on Wednesday, defense for Zimmerman summed up, this was Mark O'Mara, summing up why he thought George Zimmerman should be acquitted.
He believed reasonably that he had to do to protect himself from great bodily injury that was already being visited upon him. And if we presented evidence that helps the jury understand that, then we've done our job.
And I just want to give everybody here a flavor of the concern around this verdict when it finally comes out. This is a public service announcement released yesterday by the Broward County Police Department in Florida, featuring a diverse group of teens urging their peers not to react violently to a Zimmerman trial verdict.
Raise your voice.
And not your hands.
We need to stand together as one. No cuffs, no guns.
Let's give violence a rest, because we can easily end up arrested.
I know your patience will be tested, but law enforcement has your back.
Let's back up and choose not to act up, and deputies are with us, so no need to act tough.
Let it roll off your shoulders. It's water off your back. Don't lack composure, because in one instance, it could be over.
So let's make the choice to raise your voice and not your hands.
I'm Sheriff Scott Israel, and law enforcement does have your back.
Jack Beatty, we're in a new era here, hip-hop, to deliver the message, law enforcement has your back, let's back it up and not choose to act up. You can hear the concern right there about what may be, well, what is simmering as the jury takes this away.
Yes, you can, and it goes right to the issue of race, which the prosecution did not raise in the case. And these, you know, the legals on TV say, well, there's good reason they didn't. It's an all-white jury that probably wouldn't have gone over very well. So we heard the word profiling from the prosecutor yesterday. We didn't hear the adjective racial. And, you know, racial, it just surrounds this whole business. And the New Yorker yesterday pointed some very interesting statistics, really rather disheartening. One. There was a 2012 study by the Associated Press that found that 56% of Americans were found to hold, quote, implicit anti-black sentiments. That was an increase of 7 points in 4 years. And 51% in that study expressed explicit anti-black attitudes. So that's on the one hand, increasing anti-black attitudes among white Americans. And on the other hand, 56% of this public believes crime committed with guns has gone up over 20 years, when in fact the homicide rate has dropped by 49% and the rate of non-fatal crimes down by 72%. And yet, the black man, the possibility of crime, the act, you know, the vigilante, and that seems to be the general climate in which Mr. Zimmerman struck.
Let's go to Joe calling from Marfa, Texas. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been on two murder juries, one that convicted the defendant, and one that did not. As an advice to the jury, and then a question, yeah. The most important thing is for the jury to base it on the facts. No, the judge will instruct them that. But a lot of jurors, first of all, listen to the opening and closing statements. They have nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing to do with it. It's only what the facts are as on the stand. Second, they make decisions on whether he looks guilty or whether I like him, whether there's a racial bias. Facts is the only thing that does it. Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
When the jurors are picked, judges ask the jurors, potential jurors, could you find for execution? And everybody who's on the jury says yes, except when you get into the jury and you find that there are some of the folks that say, you know, who are in the minority and want to let them, for instance, for the defendant, they up say, I can't by my conscience ever vote for execution.
Joe, let me pick it up right there, because it was interesting how manslaughter charges were introduced late in this trial this week, so that if they don't feel like they can clear the highest bar, maybe they have something to fall back on. As I understand it, Zimmerman would face life in prison if they go with the second-degree murder charge. Manslaughter with a firearm carries a sentence up to 30 years in prison. And, of course, the issue there, the defense really pushed on, was beyond reasonable doubt. Here was the defense attorney, Mark O'Mara.
The state needs to convince you all the way down here. Self-defense likely, it's a reasonable doubt as to self-defense. The self-defense suspected. Well, you have a reasonable doubt as to self-defense, not guilty. May not be self-defense, you're not quite sure. Not guilty.
That element of doubt being raised there. Kelly O'Donnell, an all-female jury. Can you imagine the tension in that jury room as they take this off for their contemplation?
And a smaller composition of jurors than we see in a lot of other states, where there are six women who will be deciding this with some alternates. We don't always see that. Earlier in my career, I covered a lot of court cases, so I always am intensely interested in the experience of jurors. I think it's one of the most solemn things we ask citizens to do. And they do come into it having to try to push out of their minds all of those natural impulses the rest of us are allowed to engage in, sort of the larger environment of this trial and the history of some of these tensions in our country. They have to try to wall all of that off. And whatever outcome they come to, it would be so great if our society could trust in the jurors, believe in their seriousness of purpose, and hope they come to whatever conclusion it might be, that the community will respect it and not respond one way or the other, depending on how this turns out. It'll be fascinating to see if the jurors talk to us after their conclusion, what really moved them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a runaway oil train and devastating explosion in Quebec, Canada. An estimated 50 dead, missing, likely vaporized in the fireball. Maxime Picard was in a bar that's now gone. He told the Canadian press the earth shook.
We feel the earth was shaking a lot. It took 10 seconds. I get through the front door and I just saw the train. I saw the fire, and the only thing I had to do is to run.
The three women held prisoner in a Cleveland house for a decade spoke publicly for the first time since their escape in May. Here's Michelle Knight, kidnapped when she was 21, 10 years ago.
I may have been through hell and back, but I am strong enough to walk through hell with a smile on my face and with my head held high.
And the Muslim holy month of Ramadan began. Here's the opening call to prayer in Mecca on Monday in Egypt and beyond. There were maybe desperate hopes for a Ramadan calm.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
We're looking at a week in the news. Fireworks in Congress, Egypt in uproar, airliner down, the climax of the Zimmerman trial, all but the verdict. Michael Crowley is with us, senior correspondent for Time Magazine. Kelly O'Donnell's here, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News, and Jack Beatty's here. News coming out as we speak that Janet Napolitano is resigning from her post as Homeland Security Secretary to take a senior post in the University of California system. Let's go to West Palm Beach, Florida, and Francis. Hi, Francis. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I have two things to say about this Zimmerman case. Trayvon Martin, as far as he knew, was being followed by some unknown assailant in the dark, in the rain. He's weaponless. So what does he do? He feels trapped. He stands his ground and gets killed. And they're quibbling over these. Of course, Trayvon was defending himself. And he gets shot. And the second thing is, if Zimmerman had been black and Trayvon Martin white, you know Zimmerman would have been in jail that day that it happened, not 45 days later. So that's how I feel about that case.
Francis, I appreciate your call. Now, the of course there is one that the jury doesn't get to roll with, right? They're supposed to listen to all the details and figure it out. But it's easy to see it just that way. Let me get one more here. Nashville, Tennessee. Scott, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. The big question about the Zimmerman trial is, how is it that the dead kid, the victim, is drug tested and the guy who fired the gun is not? How does that happen? Now, of course, he wasn't arrested for over 40 days, so, like, how does that happen? How could it be anything other than institutionalized racism? Now, I'm just a white guy in America, but I see it like it is, and I tell you what, that is just another example of the numerous examples of institutionalized racism in this country, and it really took off and became okay when a black guy got elected president. And all of a sudden, white America woke up with their knuckles dragging, going, oh my God, what's going on? I hate everybody now.
Well,
and that's how I see it as a guy who helped end the Vietnam War by protesting the bad stuff.
Yeah, Scott, we've got it. Of course, Florida, maybe this is your idea of institutionalized. They have the Stand Your Ground law, which came right into play in that long delay before Zimmerman was even brought up on charges. Lots of issues raised this week by the prosecution. How could Trayvon Martin have seen this tiny gun in Zimmerman's waistband in the dark that he was supposed to be scrambling for, the prosecution raised? How could Martin have been punching Zimmerman, covering his mouth, reaching for the gun all at the same time? Why didn't Zimmerman suffer worse wounds to his head if, as the defense says, Trayvon Martin slammed his head against the pavement 25 times? But Trayvon Martin's gone, and there's the jury wrestling with it right now. We get one more right here. Jeff in Brockton, Iowa. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think I want to know why the trial is even going forward. I had read this week online that the prosecutor who had filed charges against Zimmerman was brought up on charges herself. So if the charges against Zimmerman were improperly filed, why is the trial even going forward?
I mean, you're beyond my technical expertise there, but everybody's watching this thing. Jack, here's Honest Debate writes to us online, says the PSA that we heard there from Broward County's Police Department is disturbing. It is inviting trouble, in my view, writes this listener. I guess to talk about anticipating a potential problem with violence, Jack.
Yes, I had that same feeling. But on the other hand, what can you do? If something did erupt and they hadn't done that, people would say, why didn't you act in advance? They're going to be. Let's just hope that this works out both justly and for the society without any rupture.
And Kanan in Augusta, Georgia. Kanan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm just very appalled that this is being turned into a race trial. This is not supposed to be turning into a race trial. This is supposed to be a remark about whether or not Zimmerman was defending himself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this is not. They're not asking whether or not he was defending himself. They're asking whether or not he was profiling. I've been on both sides of being profiled. I've been stopped by the cops because I looked suspicious before, and I've also been on the other side. I've been on neighborhood watches where I've had to profile people. I've had to look and see whether or not they're being, you know, suspicious. I've had to ask them what they're doing. And so I just think that's really a stupid thing, is because it's a race trial. That's all it is.
It's been made that you say, Michael, thank you for your call, Kane. And Michael, I mean, there's a fine line here. As Jack said, there's been a fair amount of avoiding talking about race, but not about talking about profiling. And I'm not sure what the difference is. Our Georgia caller says he's appalled it's being turned into a race trial. Of course, this thing had such huge racial resonance right from the get-go, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me the most intense conversation about race was in the very beginning and had to do with the police's initial response, which a lot of people saw as, an excessive presumption that Zimmerman had defended himself and was in his rights. The question of profiling, I suppose, could have some legal relevance to the extent that if the jury is going to convict him of murder, intent is crucial to that. What was going through his mind? Why did he pull the trigger? The legal definition there involves phrases like something like evil intent. I don't know. Not being a lawyer, I can't tell you whether profiling would allow them. You know, they could kind of build that into their reasoning. But I do think that whatever decision they reach, that they're going to be trying to some degree to get into Zimmerman's mind. And by the way, this is why I think that the availability of a manslaughter conviction seems to me, again, not as a lawyer, to be bad news for Zimmerman. I would be worried about that because I think that the legal analysis I've heard suggesting that there really is reasonable doubt here. Whatever you may feel about Zimmerman as a person and how he conducted himself that night up until the somewhat unclear final moments, it does seem that there is quite a lot of doubt about precisely how those last seconds played out, particularly as it would require a murder conviction. But, you know, manslaughter is a lower bar.
Yep.
And I just think that could end up being – it was a late development in this trial, but to me it's a very significant one. And I think that – I'd be very nervous about that if I was George Zimmerman.
Second-degree murder, a higher bar, as you say. They have to show that the killer had a depraved mind, harbored ill will, hatred, or spite. And the analysis I'm reading here saying, you know, this is why the prosecution jumped right away on those early – on that tape they brought up very early of Zimmerman saying, punks, you know, they always get away. One more call on this. We've got more to look at. Daryl in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Daryl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, I've been watching this trial through it all, you know, at night and stuff.
Yes, sir.
And I just don't think that Trayvon was ever on top of that guy. I think that guy followed him, and he walked up and grabbed a hold of him and was going to hold him till the police got there. And Trayvon probably did hit him in the nose, and he probably slipped in and fell in that wet grass and stuff. And then he pulled that gun out and shot him. I don't think he was ever on top of him, my view.
Daryl, I appreciate your call. I mean, everybody's been watching this, thinking it through. Lots of opinions. It's going to be that jury that makes the decision, and probably pretty soon. I want to turn to Egypt. Very dramatic developments there after very dramatic developments the week before. The big killing this week. On Monday, one Muslim Brotherhood member says here that the protests by the Muslim Brotherhood are more than the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi, now. Here he is interpreted by Euronews.
The issue for me and for all of us here at this sit-in is not related to the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. The issues are the freedoms that are beginning to be eroded after the coup. There are lots of arrest warrants being issued, almost 1,000 for the Brotherhood, and others.
And of course, hundreds wounded, 50 plus dead in that big shooting on Monday. The next day, retired Egyptian General Sami Saif Eliazal told Voice of America the Muslim Brotherhood had to choose between joining the new government or continuing violence in the street with consequences.
It's their choice. It's the choice of Muslim Brotherhood now. If they want to join the new political forces in Egypt, or they want, even as an opposition group, no problem at all. Or they will stay carrying weapons, carrying Kalashnikovs, and killing people.
Michael Crowley, we're hearing warnings of Egypt on the brink of civil war this week. Do you see it that way, or settling down?
No, well, I think we certainly are on the brink. There are some pro-Muslim Brotherhood marches planned, I believe, for the weekend, and there's a lot of nervousness about whether they will escalate into violence. The military did kill, I believe it's 51 pro-Brotherhood protesters earlier this week.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Obama administration's position here is a very delicate and shall we say, nuanced one. In which the president is trying to avoid taking a side and saying we prefer one side to the other. What we want is a democratic process. What we want is essentially values that we can support, which include freedom of speech and assembly. And the president has been urging the military to restrain itself. But, you know, it's not clear that that's what the military is doing. The military is not doing that. There has been violence. The military is arresting a lot of people, clamping down on pro-Brotherhood media and spokesmen. And I'll be interested to see where Obama draws the line and says, okay, I can't stand by and watch this happen anymore, and either rhetorically smacks down the military or possibly invokes the option he has to cut off American aid to Egypt. We sent about $1.5 billion per year. $1.3 billion of it goes directly to the military. thus far, the administration has clearly not wanted to do that because they like the sort of access and influence that aid buys us with the military, which they see as a relatively pro-American liberalizing force. But it remains to be seen. The military is really pushing it, I think.
I mean, I wonder about how much influence the U.S. really has, though, where this ultimately goes. Huge forces unleashed in Egypt. We've got a listener here, Al Sordi, says no change in Egypt. The Egyptian military is still in charge, and the USA still controls the Egyptian military. All the rest is democracy theatrics. Really? Does the U.S. really have that big a role, an influence here, Michael?
Well, no, I think that it's interesting to watch the debate play out here, and it's interesting to talk to observers from afar who kind of chuckle and say the conversation in Washington seems to suggest, you know, what is Obama going to do? How is he going to fix it? You know, how are we going to make this right? And we really don't have that much influence. We give $1.5 billion a year in aid in the days after the military's intervention, if call it a coup, if you like. The Saudis and the Qataris together ponied up something like $8 billion.
I think you mean Saudis and UAE. Qataris supported the Muslim Brotherhood, but the UAE has swung in with the new government.
Yes, I apologize. Mm-hmm. Something like $8 billion to prop up their economy. It's those countries in the region that are really the big players that are going to make those determinations. That said, our ties with the military there are real. They're important. The money does help establish them. So it's not totally insignificant. But no, we are not. Obama's not going to wave a magic wand and fix this.
Let's go to Canada with a terrible, terrible runaway train this week. Brad in Montreal in Quebec. Brad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to say that we probably won't know the real causes of this disastrous rail derailment. It's kind of Quebec's 9/11. And I'd also like to say that it'll probably prompt the Obama administration to give the go-ahead to the Keystone XL pipeline with transport. Well, because here there's a kind of angst or rising anxiety about the transportation of these petroleum mm-hmm. tanks on rail. And many people here think or perceive that it would be safer to have it transported on the North American continent through pipelines, although environmentalists argue that pipelines are no panacea either, and there have been pipeline spills. But this terrible tragedy, I think, has really been the tipping point for this pipeline debate.
And I think Obama will approve the Keystone Pipeline.
Fascinating. Kelly O'Donnell, of course, yes, there's this argument that it's too dangerous to move this huge volume of oil on wheels, safer in a pipeline. And then here comes this fiery, deadly derailment runaway just on the brink of sometime soon a Keystone XL pipeline decision in Washington.
It's so fascinating how a tragedy of that magnitude becomes a very potent political argument. And there has been a sense that the administration was moving closer to an approval of the Keystone Pipeline. There was many who viewed that the president's strong stand with respect to climate change and some of the issues where his administration is weighing in more heavily now was, in fact, a step before there might be the approval of the pipeline, which is supported by some Democrats, those who are in sort of the line of being beneficiaries where their states are in the pathway of that, much more broadly supported by Republicans. But it is an interesting argument in sort of a real-world scenario of what can go desperately wrong when you're moving that level of potent fuel on the ground. But we'll have to see if that is enough to move that. But it's an interesting way to put those two different scenarios together. It's very compelling.
Jack, stakes as high as they could be here, and you hear that with the mind there moving in Montreal right away. About how decisions ultimately get made. Boy, that terrible, terrible week for the village by the rails in Canada. Just devastated.
Horrifying.
I want to thank each of you for being with us this hour. Michael Crowley, senior correspondent for Time Magazine. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Kelly O'Donnell with NBC News. Thanks for being here, Kelly.
Always enjoy it, Tom. Thanks.
And Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.